The following program was brought to you by Bird, Brooklyn's first fashion destination, leading the fashion pack across the river since 1999. Bird has been voted Best Women's Boutique in New York City by New York Magazine, Top Visionary Boutique in the United States by Lucky Magazine, and has received extensive coverage in the New York Times. For more, visit shopbird.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I'm in the studio today with Martha Hoover and Chef Neera Kahar, and we're already talking about their future collaboration, which is really exciting.
We're on a project right now.
Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. On the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Monday at 1 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'm joined by two extremely inspiring women. In the first segment, I'll be talking to Martha Hoover. Martha is responsible for shifting the food tide in Indianapolis with her restaurants and her new foundation, the Padishu Foundation, which includes a great business model in the form of her new restaurant and, would you call it a micro farm? Is that right?
Micro farm.
A micro farm called Public Greens. And in the second segment, I'll be talking to Chef Neera Kahar, who's visiting New York from New Delhi and last week was the first female chef ever from India to cook a meal at the James Beard Foundation, which is awesome. Martha, let's start with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for asking.
I'm thrilled. And by coincidence, two of your kids are having lunch in the next room.
You know, I texted them this morning and they said they were coming to Roberta's for lunch. And I said, wait a minute, I'll be there too.
That's so fun. What a small world. All roads lead to Bushwick. I want to spend most of today talking about and really celebrating Public Greens and the foundation. But I want to back up to, I guess, a little over 25 years ago before you opened your first restaurant. Your background is decidedly not in food. Can you tell everyone a little bit about what you were doing before you...
My educational background, by default, was not in food. I was a sex crimes prosecutor in Indianapolis, Indiana. Although I felt really proud of what I was doing, this was in the 80s. It was at a time when sex crimes prosecution were basically an unknown, and we were part of the second sex crimes unit team in the United States to be created. So we really felt like we were, you know, at the very head of creating this niche protection for women and children. But my history has always been very involved in food. And, you know, even as a young child in high school, I saved money babysitting and took myself to this wonderful summer trip in France, lived with the family, and just became mesmerized.
How old were you?
I was 17 when I first went. And, you know, I'm 60 now, so 17 was an entire world ago. And people weren't, there was no internet, you know, no Facebook. Going to Europe seemed as exotic as it would be going to India today or something. And it seemed relatively brave at the moment, when I was doing it. But once I was there, it was truly not the museums and the architecture or even the countryside that I fell in love with. It was remarkably the food at the table. And it was the rustic, you know, cuisine that I just could not get enough of.
And did you grow up in a family that loved food? Was that...
I grew up in a family that loved food. Grew up mostly in Texas before we moved to Indianapolis for my father's profession. But my parents were New Yorkers. And I grew up with this family mantra that all the great food in the world starts and ends in New York. Mm. And, you know, in the 60s, I grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, really that was true. But what I never understood, and I kind of had this thought when I was about 12, I didn't understand why Indiana was a farm state and why we couldn't have even better food. And I had an experience that was one of those experiences that really changed my life. We would make the trek home every year for the Jewish holidays from Texas to Brooklyn, New York, and where my mother was from. And I remember going to a produce market and seeing, this must have been in the September holiday season, and seeing a melon from Posey County, Indiana. And I'll never forget, it was something outrageous for the times, like $5. Mm. And I remember my father saying, oh my God, this melon is Posey County melon. And I had no idea what that meant. But then he said it was from a small county in Indiana. And I was like, well, I've never tasted a Posey County melon. Why did we have to come to Brooklyn, New York to have this experience? Yeah. And it really began, I think, that moment began kind of my food awareness, you know?
Sort of connecting it to a place.
Yeah, to a region, to a location.
And how did you make the leap, sort of jumping ahead, how did you make the leap from being a public sector lawyer to being a restaurateur? How did that happen?
Well, I was really, I loved what I did professionally, but I did not have tremendous passion for it. I felt like I was doing something really worthwhile, but my heart always belonged in food. And I just finally really had the support and encouragement from my husband and friends, who I was the person in the office who wasn't necessarily consulted regarding legal theory, but I was always consulted regarding a recipe. So I decided that maybe it was time to open up a place. And truly, at the time I opened my first restaurant, I was... I'd never worked in a restaurant. I did not know I was pregnant with my third child. But what I did know was that there was no restaurant in Indianapolis, Indiana at the time, really anywhere that I had been in the United States, that served the kind of food that I wanted my children to eat. And I lived in a neighborhood, a spot came available, and I said, I will open up my own little restaurant, not really having any historic perspective to it. I just wanted to open up a restaurant where I thought my friends, family would enjoy eating my food.
And what kind of food? How would you describe that food?
Well, you know, this was at a time way before the term farm to table was even in existence in our lexicon. It was homemade. Mm-hmm. That's what we called it back then. When I opened in 1989, the idea of a truly homemade meal being prepared in a kitchen was non-existent. Indianapolis has always been a chain city. We've never had a real history of ethnic or independent restaurants. We really never had a history of independent restaurants either as a result of that. So I did everything that I wasn't supposed to do. I opened up a restaurant having had no experience. I opened up a restaurant with two young children at home, a busy husband, and I was pregnant. And I opened up a restaurant not knowing that I wasn't supposed that I wasn't supposed to be doing things the way I was doing it, which was truly homemade, going to farmers that I knew, and establishing some great relationships with them that I still have today.
Wow, that's amazing.
Really proud of.
If you could go back knowing everything you know now, we're going to jump ahead in a minute to everything you've done since you opened the restaurant, would you do anything differently? Or
absolutely not. I think the fact that it was so accidental and naive, and probably sometimes I think those are the best accidents. I think now one of the I love everything that's going on with the food movement, and you know, this entire generation of people doing really cool things in the food world. But I think that to have the historic perspective that I had of a time when none of this was common and you had to really struggle and work, I remember going to the airport almost every day to get something as that you can get now at any Wendy's or McDonald's called a field greens. We had to actually bring them in on a plane. They were unheard of in Indianapolis.
Wow, times have changed.
You know, the one thing I think I would do I would like to redo is I don't think that I told our story enough early enough.
Interesting.
Because it just didn't strike a chord with enough people.
Interesting.
You know?
That's a really, wow. So that was in 1989, just 25 years ago. How many restaurants sort of / restaurant concepts do you now operate?
I have 3, soon to be 4 restaurant concepts, and we are opening up my 11th location in about 3 weeks.
Amazing. All in Indianapolis.
All in Indianapolis. No.
Let's talk about your most recent project, Public Greens.
Public Greens.
It sounds incredible. It sounds like the sort of modern cafeteria which was in every neighborhood. Is that accurate?
It's 100% accurate.
And what kind of, tell us about the space.
Well, the space, we are located on the Public Greenway in Indianapolis, something called the Monon Trail. We are located in a building that has no historic significance, but I actually was able to work out a lease agreement with the city for an entire block on this green space.
Wow, amazing.
So it'd be like a block on the Highland or something, the Highland, your public green space in New York. And what we did is we took this building and we repurposed everything. We left the building intact, completely gutted it. To create our restaurant there. But what we did that I think is most unique, especially in our urban environment, is we took the entire green space and are in the process of planting a micro farm. And all of the produce that will be grown in the micro farm by our dedicated farmer, a young farmer from Anderson, Indiana, from a farming family who works solely for us. All the produce will go to the restaurant, and the restaurant will also share it with our feeding program that we do through a foundation that my company started in 2013 called the Potashoe Foundation.
Yeah, so all the proceeds from
The restaurant is unique in many ways because not only of its site being on a public green space, having this large piece of property associated with it that we've turned into the micro farm, but I'm most proud of the fact that it is a for-profit restaurant, but we have dedicated all of the profits to go directly to our foundation. The foundation's mission is very simple. It is to feed whole and nutritious food, after-school meals, actually, to children in our community who suffer with daily food insecurity. Over 80% of the children living in the public school district of Indianapolis Public School, IPS, live at or below poverty.
Wow.
And suffer from daily food insecurity. Wow. It's one of the largest food insecure populations in the country. My feeling has always been with all of my food that I serve my customers and my family alike, that food is not an elitist proposition. And that really high quality food should be accessible to everybody.
That's so wonderful.
So it is. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, as you should be.
So all the profits are going to the foundation, which in turn feeds children.
Where does that happen? Where are these kids getting the after school meals that you're providing?
We actually go to community centers where the children come to for after school counseling, tutoring, after school care.
Activities and stuff.
Activities,
great. So you're going to them. They're not coming
to you. We go to them, and we not only go to them, we didn't want to be food throwers. There are a lot of food throwers out there. So we have a really ambitious, I think, dietary education, very interactive program.
That's
and
so great.
And the kids help us with the gardening, with the cooking, the serving, the cleanup, all of it. And what we find is that even at a very young age, age 5 or 6, they become very excited about the new taste and new flavors and what they're learning about food.
It seems to be the best way to get,
a kid
to eat a vegetable is for them to grow it or to have some participation
absolutely.
In that moment.
And, absolutely. Yeah. When we started with the idea, we were told by many people in the, there are so many people trying to do stuff with hunger issues. And one of the things that we were continuously told was that the children wouldn't eat the kind of food that we made. I mean, my goal was to make food that I would feed my customers, not just, I wouldn't dumb down. We've dumbed down food for children, have never had a children's menu. I've always said on my menu since 1989, we don't have a specialty menu just for children. Children should eat what adults eat. They should eat the same thing, smaller portions. And we'll downsize the portion, but not the menu.
That's great. It reminds me a lot of, I don't know if you read yesterday's magazine section, the New York Times, the food issue, and it was all about what kids have been eating what they should eat, et cetera, et cetera. And it sounds
I
like
will
you're doing
read
all the
it
right things
tonight when I'm in bed on the plane back. Yeah, on the plane back.
No, it's, I mean, you're part of such an important movement. And it reminds me, the first guest who came on Radio Cherry Bomb was Kate Brashares, who runs Edible Schoolyard in New York City. And
I had actually breakfast with her in Chicago not too long ago, talking about our common missions. Yeah.
On Friday, I got to visit the garden, which was so great after talking to her about it on the show. And a fifth grader who has had this garden in his curriculum since he was in, I guess, kindergarten or pre-kindergarten, gave us the tour. And it was so meaningful to hear about what an impact this has had on his life. And it sounds like you're doing all that same kind of work in Indianapolis.
You know, we did this project this summer with, we had 80 kids that we fed daily at one of our city parks. And 100% of the kids, 100% of the counselors suffer from food insecurity and lived way below poverty in very, very difficult home life situation. And we brought in the most amazing homemade bread from our restaurant that was still piping hot. Mm-hmm. And we taught them all how to make butter. And for most of these kids, it was their first experience with a high quality bread, something that was really good. And most of them had never tasted real butter. And if you could have, I have pictures. I would love to share those. It was one of those moments, I think, that will create memories for them forever. And even when I see some of the kids at some of the centers that we go to and are feeding, they talk about the butter and the bread. I think that's exquisite.
So I mean, food, I know from personal experiences, I mean, it stays with you, and those memories can inform so many different experiences. And
absolutely.
That's great that you're providing those. What are the plans for the foundation? Where do you see it in 5 years and 10 years?
You know, the plan right now, originally the short-term plan was to be immediately impactful and to make a difference. One of our issues that I've always had with our giving strategy through the company, company's always been as philanthropic as we possibly could be from day one. But what I found over the years is that our giving was scattershot. It didn't have any focus. And then when it did have focus, I found that we're still a small company. We give away what I think is a lot of money, but it didn't make the impact to the end user that I had hoped, nor did our giving make an impact with my staff. And I had to be really honest. I was getting all the credit for writing the $5,000, $10,000 checks that we were giving away to many organizations in our community. But it was really the hard work of my staff that was allowing me to have that privilege of writing checks. And I really wanted to do something that connected the staff as well. So our goal was to do something that connected the staff that also was immediately impactful to our community. One of the reasons why we decided to donate our profits to the foundation is my other frustration regarding doing community service was that most organizations are so busy chasing money all the time that, again, the impact to the end user is not as strong as it should be.
Yeah.
So we think that this way we'll have some sustainability to our foundation. Our medium range plans for the foundation is to feed more children on a daily basis. We literally have had a drop, not in a bucket, but a drop in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that the business model of having this incredible restaurant associated with the micro farm that then fuels and feeds a foundation that feeds children.
Thing.
I think it's full circle. And I think there is not a community in the United States that I know of that does not have a population that could use this help. And I really think that we could do something very big with
That's wonderful. And I think by empowering everyone that you work with and works for you, I mean, the ability to pay it forward just gets exponential. So
I am most proud of the fact that our organization is 100% run by our staff and staff
That's
volunteers.
Great. That's wonderful. Well, that's so great, Martha. Your achievements and your plans are just so inspiring. It's amazing to hear about everything you've built. And I know we're all really excited to see what happens next. And
thank you.
Rooting you on. Before we say goodbye in sort of lighter news, I have to perform the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A with you. Which
Uh-oh, no one told me about this.
We try to keep it a secret, so there's no pressure and there's no preparation. Really easy, no pressure. Okay, question one, sweet or salty?
Salty.
Salty. What did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, actually, my breakfast was this lovely salad at Roberta's. Oh. I didn't.
Perfect. if I were to look into your refrigerator right now, which might be hard because you are not where you live right now.
I am proud of my refrigerator. I will tell you why. I have several. Is that what you're asking me?
Go ahead. No, I want to hear it.
I have some non-pasteurized goat milk. I have half and half for my coffee in the morning. I have, and I can, this is the honest God truth, because I actually, when I put the goat milk in the other day, I noticed I had three bottles of champagne that I was so happy, pre-chilling for me. And then I have lots of butter, ridiculous amount of mostly French butter with some Vermont butter and cheese, butter with salt stuck in there for good measure.
That Vermont butter and cheese, it's, their it butter is amazing.
Yeah, it's crack butter.
It's crack butter. What's your go-to snack?
Unfortunately, going back to the salty, mm-hmm. I'm a tortilla chip and potato chip. That's my vice with food. Love that stuff.
I hear you. What's your favorite time of day?
About 4 o'clock. It's when my office empties out. Mm-hmm. Everyone goes home. We start really early. We're mostly a breakfast restaurant. So our production kitchen and office team gets in at, 5 a.m. The morning. So they leave early. I enjoy the office when it's really quiet and I get to do some real thinking and planning.
The chips come out.
And that's usually when the chips come in. Yeah.
That's so funny. Where would you love to travel to next?
I'm lucky. I get lots of opportunities to travel. I have children who have lived all over the place, and I love visiting them. But my go-to place for inspiration is always and has always been, since I took my first trip when I was very young, to Paris. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually planning on going in a couple of months again. I've been there twice this year so far.
That's great.
We're doing a really interesting culinary trip with some staff members in September. And starting off in Paris. So I'm very excited about that.
Cool. My last question, my favorite question is, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
I know I'm supposed to say something about my mother's fine cooking in case she's listening, but really my favorite meal when I was a child was a coq au vin that we used to get at this little, strangely, French restaurant run by a French chef in Mooresville, Indiana. It makes no sense that he was there. Unfortunately, he died way before I understood what the full story was, but he made some of the most remarkable coq au vin. And when we were lucky enough to go out, that many years ago, people didn't eat out with the frequency. When we were lucky enough to go out and celebrate as a family at a restaurant, that was usually our celebration restaurant. And I can still taste that coq au vin today.
That's so great. So French food.
It was French food, really.
And a restaurant
delicious.
Where you might not expect it. So that's great. Martha, where can people find you and your businesses, your restaurants, everything online?
Potashoe.com.
And everything's there.
Everything Wonderful. Links to that, great. Yes.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you.
Really appreciate the
opportunity.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, it's terrific. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to be back with Neera.
Today's program is brought to you by Bird. After first opening in Park Slope in 1999, a second location in Cobble Hill was opened in 2006. The third and largest location, designed by Norwegian architect Ole Sandresen, opened in Williamsburg in 2009 and is the first LEED-certified retail store in New York City. Bird offers a wide range of contemporary and luxury collections for men and women, in addition to supporting and showcasing emerging local designers and artists. Bird is Brooklyn's first fashion destination, leading the fashion pack across the river since 1999. Bird has been voted Best Women's Boutique in New York City by New Yorker Magazine, Top Visionary Boutique in the United States by Lucky Magazine, and has received extensive coverage in the New York Times. For more, visit shopbird.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I'm so happy to have Chef Neera Kahar here with me for the second segment. Neera, I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm so sorry. Neera and Martha are having a real connection, which is wonderful. Neera, where are you from originally?
I'm from Montreal, Canada. So, yeah, I'm like I was saying, I'm a proper French-Canadian girl with an Indian exterior and Indian parents.
And you now live in India.
I've been living in India for 7 years now, in New Delhi.
And you run Shay Nini.
Shay Nini, yes.
Wonderful. Tell us about where Shay Nini is.
Shay Nini is in an up-and-coming market called Meherchand Market. It's, funnily enough, been known as a tailor's market. It was a refugee market originally. During the time of separation, a lot of families are relocated into this market and no one really knows the history of it, but it's amazing. It went for, it somehow became, it was a residential market, but then the people who were the refugees started to use the front space as a commercial space as a means to make money. And, you know, and through time it has had two lives. It kind of died down because of a nearby market that had opened up. And then this market revived again as a tailor's market. And so when I was thinking of opening Shay Nini there, it came with a lot of resistance and everyone is like, it's been around forever, but it's literally in this most central prime location of the city and somehow has had not had any commercial success till date. Yeah.
And now, and so you've been in that space for how long?
For, I think we've been there for like almost 3.5, coming to 4 years.
Yeah. And have other restaurants or food businesses?
Well, yeah, it's boomed.
So you really...
So we sparked it up.
So you and Martha have quite a bit in common for sure. Is it right that you originally planned to be an engineer? Is that correct?
I was an engineer,
actually. You were an engineer.
Yeah, I was a computer engineer. I double majored software and hardware. Yeah. And then I had a handicapping injury, which I was bedridden for 8 months to a year with chronic pain.
Wow. Yeah. And then you came out of that
experience. I had a very cliched but very useful existential crisis, because I think if life had not winded me that way, I would not have really seen a creative path as a career path. You know, I was kind of always this big geek, loved physics, but always tied in physics with like spirituality and philosophy, and that was my most interesting and kind of alluring aspect of it. And then applying it to computers really opened up my mind to an abstract kind of a knowledge, which, you know,
it was
mind and heart. It opened my heart to a lot of hard work and discipline, and I think it's really useful in owning and running a restaurant, actually, funnily enough.
I'm sure. And then how did you make that leap to
Well campaign? You know, through a lot of conversations and a lot of introspection, and, you know, when you're going through, I meditated through a lot of the pain. I don't believe in taking allopathic medicine, so I did a lot of Ayurvedic medicine, a lot of meditation. I was going through extreme chronic pain. I was very badly injured. I thought I was invincible, as most of us do, and especially at that age. And when you're winded and you're thrown, I can't even say on my back, because nor could I sit down or lie down or walk without excruciating pain. You really start to think of the fact that life doesn't go on forever. And as cliched as this is, I think everyone I speak to feels this, is that when you allow yourself to be where you are and feel what you feel and want what you want, you may want something completely different to what you're actually doing. We're often driven by fear. We're driven by expectations and wants, which are not actually, we can't actually identify with. So I started to identify with what I actually really wanted and who I actually really was. And I needed a chance to be creative. I always danced and played instruments and did that. And it was always an extracurricular activity. But then I was like, oh, I can live a life where my extracurricular and the things that really make me happy could be my life.
Yeah.
But I would never regret being an engineer.
I think that's one of the hardest things to wrap your mind around. And yeah, it sounds like it should be.
I think I'm privileged that the worst thing that ever happened to me was actually the best thing that ever happened to me.
Well, it sounds like you've worked through it in an amazing way.
And, oh, thank you.
And it's landed you in this incredible place. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing at Shay Nini. So you were trained in classical French cooking, technique, everything.
Yes.
And that happened in Montreal?
In Montreal at ITHQ. Mm-hmm. It's an institute of culinary. It's a hotel school. And they do a French culinary program, which I did. But I can say my training has been through my life. I have had my mom's... as like an amazing cook. She hates cooking, but amazing. Montreal is like an epicenter of culinary, amazing, like kind of global culinary epicenter. So my palate has been trained unconsciously my whole life, and then consciously went to culinary school and did. And I think that technical French understanding and learning is so important to get building blocks and to develop your intuition and your voice and learn how to enhance and develop and balance flavors and tastes and technique on how to deal with product was essential.
Yeah. And so then you opened your restaurant and you combined all of this technique and all these influences with ingredients that were...
Yeah, I think I don't think I consciously did anything. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've consciously been doing anything for a very long time. And since I always say, like, take your steps and let life take over. I'm learning more and more that surrender. And I think that it's not a surrender where you give up. It's a surrender where you give in to something amazing. So I don't, when people say like, how did you come up with Shainini? It's been an organic growth. I didn't even want to open a restaurant. The logistics scared the hell out of me. I'd never really worked very long at any restaurant. I just felt like this is something I know how to do. This is something that makes complete sense to me, even though it really shouldn't. And so I'm going to run with it. And that's kind of what happened. And I workshopped through different, like I was saying, telling you before, the product and the ingredients looked kind of like what were the leftovers at the farmer's markets I'd been to when I was little. And they looked starved. And today they're a product that I have genuinely fallen in love with. And they've made me grow as a chef, as has the country, as has the teams I've had to work with and the people I've interacted with. So I would say that it's an amalgamation of different experiences and challenges and stories and people that have brought Shainini to where it is today. There was no one vision. Mm-hmm. It was kind of the idea of trying to be sustainable, the idea of telling a story, and the idea of letting it come to me and to work with that. And I'm blessed to have the privilege of having the chance to done that.
That's so wonderful. Yeah. I think so much of what you said applies to people, you know, of course, in the restaurant industry, but to any industry or any place in life.
And I'm most inspired by so many creatives. Like art is equally my obsession as food is, if not more, because it inspires me the most, I would say.
Some might say they're the same thing.
Yeah, I do. I think
so. For sure. How did you, in terms of those things that worried you, you were saying about the logistics of running a restaurant, how did you overcome that? Do you work with someone who helps do the sort of business end of the restaurant? Did you sort of learn that? Teach yourself, or
I was completely self-taught. Mm-hmm. I'm still kind of keeping my fingers crossed that magical person shows up. I think it's made me so much stronger, so much more of myself. Mm-hmm. I was speaking to a wonderful. I had did an interview this morning, and she asked me such an amazing question. She's just like, sorry. She was like, how did you come to go not wanting a restaurant to doing it?
Sure, yeah.
And I think it's the challenges that kind of bring forward your story and your and what you want to do with it, right? India is not an easy place. It's probably 10 times more difficult than New York or Montreal. Everything is kind of working against you. Mm-hmm. It sounds really weird, but it's beautiful because everything is up and coming. And there's that opportunity that maybe my parents, when they came here in the 70s, felt. So I feel like it's kind of like, again, full circle, like kind of what you guys were describing. And not from there. So when people from there are like, oh, how have you done this? How are you doing this on your own? And et cetera, et cetera. I feel like it's good that I'm in a space that's foreign to me and that I'm facing these challenges on my own, because it makes it even more unique in that
way,
you know?
Yeah, that's wonderful. How do you have any family in New Delhi, or is everyone in Montreal?
No, I don't.
And how does your family feel about what you're doing?
I think at first they were really shocked. They're like, why are you going to India? You have a comfortable life over here. And I didn't even really know I was going. I was going on a 3-month internship and I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the organized chaos. I fell in love with how I love Canada. I love Montreal, but it's so sterile and it's like everything is set up for you. Everything is safe. Safety is not something you're supposed to run away from, but like, I mean, in the sense that it wasn't driving out of me what I needed. And I didn't even realize that. Like I said, life brought that to me. Sure. And I got to India and I was like, this is crazy. And I look on the exterior like everybody else, but I don't understand what's happening. And I see a throbbing potential that I want to be part of. So I'm not going to give up on that. Even if it was very scary to continue staying there, I was like, you know what? It feels right.
You jumped into the deep end.
Yeah.
Wow. Let's talk about what brought you to New York. Talk about another sort of challenge that came up. You were invited to cook at the James Beard Foundation. I'm so happy. I feel like I read a lot of press about the anticipation surrounding the meal that you served on Friday. I'm so happy to be talking to you after you served it. How did it go?
See, everyone tells me that I maybe am too candid, but I can't help it. I
mean, radio, so whatever.
I come from a family where we do not ever hold our tongue. So I think the foundation was extremely supportive. They're super professional. And they have so much soul. They're not like just like a cold professional, mm-hmm. give you what you need. Like, they were there for me as if they knew me forever. Mm-hmm. They supported me in every way possible. But food is like a living organism of sorts. It has its own moods. It has its own freaks, things that happen. And, you know, like 10 minutes before my dinner started, the deep fryer broke. Six of my things were meant to be fried. The hand so blender, you know what I mean? Like, all these things. And I had literally met the team I worked with at 3 o'clock
that day. Yeah.
So there's, it's a difficult
Tell
situation.
How many people you were serving?
80
just
people.
To get a sense of
80 okay. people. Yeah. And you know what? It was probably one of the steepest, best learning curves mm-hmm. I've experienced. I'm so happy. I would say everyone walked away very happy, but for me, I was like, it's 30% of the performance I'd hoped for. And I kind of realized that that's just, again, part of the way things go. And, yeah. and you know, next time. Next
what did you, what happened when the deep fryer broke and those items?
Well, you know, you're kind of like a MacGyver
yeah.
in the kitchen as a chef. Everybody is yeah. like, these are the things that you can't ever control. And you don't, you know, put your hands up and like, that's it. We boiled huge, huge stock pots of oil mm-hmm. and we had four of them running. Vegetarian, and we had to keep reheating those. It caused a delay, but I think everyone was drinking and merry and happy. And
I feel like in those moments, I've had a lot of, I did a lot of work as a private chef, and yeah. I feel like the amount of things that happen that like the people you're serving, they don't know about, and they also don't need to know about.
They don't need to know. And yeah. the team I was working with was fantastic.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
great. I didn't know them. I just met them. One of the girls, Emily, had already been working with me for a couple, like 4 or 5 days. I maybe should have hired more people. It was like, I kind of didn't know the circuit of chefs and stuff. I'm kind of getting to know now. But it's just so amazing how much heart people give, how much mm-hmm. time, how much effort, how much care. It touched me. Like, I felt safer and it's okay. Everything's going to work out. Because a lot of these, like, Emily had been working with the foundation many times before. She's like, don't worry about it. And like, the team at the foundation was so reassuring, so helpful. So
great.
You work through it.
It sounds like it was pretty yeah. great. How long did you spend preparing the menu?
Oh, so it's been an interesting process because, excuse me, I felt like if I was going to, the James Beard Foundation, and you know, generally the culinary scene in New York for me is probably the epitome of showcasing creativity, and for a chef to not necessarily follow classic interpretations of things, but I feel like chefs here really bring their best foot forward. Like, they really bring their personalities into the food. They work with the farmers around them. They work with artists. They create experiences. And for me, that's like exactly what mm-hmm. I want to do. It's not only what's on the table. So I prepared special. I do this in my restaurant. I design the crockery. I work with different wow. artisans. Awesome. I work with brass. I work with metals. I worked with a metal worker who did the tree, and I used all recycled metals to build that tree. Everything is like, you know, older furniture, which I kind of like refurbish. And then when I was doing, I kind of wanted that to be reflected in the menu as well. And 4.5 years of sleeping, maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, doesn't give you much headspace for this. I took 20 days off. I was like, I was not feeling well. So I'm like, this is it. Slept for 5 days straight and then woke up from that intense amount of sleep and realized that since I'm about 8 years old, I've been obsessed with Ayurveda and yoga and mindfulness. And mindfulness is just a word that kept coming up again and again in the way I wanted to live my life, the kind of food I wanted to feed people. But mindfulness is also a balanced perspective of indulgence, a spiritual kind of an angle where you're bringing your whole self and a good energy into your food, of using the ingredients around you in their natural form. And to me, nature is perfect. So it emanates the perfect balance that I want to achieve in my life. So I kind of look to it now, and I've come full circle from trying to be like, technically this is, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like use these, maybe some part of molecular gastronomy. I feel like it's an intuition that kind of develops, and that you get closer and closer to what the true nature of the food is and adding your accents and highlights to it. So I thought, okay, well, since Ayurveda and the concept is so pure and it's like a pure truth, I want to bring that into my story, because it's been part of my story. It's just that you're there and sometimes you don't see everything that's influencing you. So I started to write and I started to read, and I read this really cute book called Buddhism for Sheep. And the process of that book somehow brought my story to me. And I divided this five chapters according to the five tastes.
Martha and I are writing this down. we're on Amazon right now.
Sorry, the six tastes. So I divided the story into the tastes of Ayurveda. So it was sweet, sour, salty, stringent, pungent, and bitter. And I started to write the story according to these tastes and write chapters to this story because I wanted to bring meaning to this. I was like, chefs like Danielle Boulud and Alice Waters have been on this platform and they, I respect and they're so revered. And how will I go onto a platform and give it the respect it deserves and to use this opportunity to bring meaning mm-hmm. to this opportunity? I was like, well, by being myself, completely being myself, good, bad, whatever it is, bring it forward and give that to people. And stories are what I live for. I live for hearing other people's stories, not always very easily telling mine. It, you know, being the protagonist of your own story is more challenging. You know, telling stories through food, through seeing people's artwork, through hearing music. And that's genuinely what I live for. So I use the kind of structure and blueprint of Ayurveda to tell my story.
Amazing.
Wow. And not in a strict and very like regimented, it has to be completely 100% Ayurvedic. People have a misconception where it's very regimented and strict, where in reality, it's a way of life. And it allows people to, it's very flexible and allows people to kind of adjust it to their own comforts, balancing obviously and following certain rules. So as I started to tell the story through these chapters, I was like, oh, I'll divide my courses through these chapters. And I start to speak to Ayurvedic professionals and ask them, what is the sequence of these six flavors that you're supposed to eat in a meal? Because you're supposed to balance the six flavors in every meal you have. So I found out that sequence and I started to develop, according to the story and according to the taste, certain meals for the dinner at James Beard. So let's just say the sweet, which you're supposed to open your appetite with. You're supposed to, ironically enough, people eat sweet at the end. But sweet doesn't mean dessert sweet. Mm-hmm. It means like pumpkin and lentil. And so my amuse-bouche was fermented lentils with a pumpkin brandad and quick lime candied pumpkins. And the great morel, which is like from Kashmir. So it was like buttered morels. And it's a lot of what I've always wanted to kind of do at the restaurant, but that's not something necessarily like maybe my team can always achieve and stuff. So it's like all my imagination and the stories that kind of bubbled up so in such a beautiful way. I got to express that.
Sounds like such a magical
night. It was really great.
And I feel like it sounds like food for you has been this way to incorporate all these influences and, you know, it
is.
Like you've approached the world with your eyes very open and you're expressing it well.
And funnily enough, and I can't believe she said that, but it's like a drop in an infinite universe. Mm, yeah. I feel like there's an endless amount of, I don't have enough lives to kind of do what I want to do. Like it's unbelievable. Every time I go to a restaurant, I'm like, this is an amazing expression. Every time I go to the museum, I'm like, but I just feel like it's about being completely present, like everywhere. Yeah. Cause you're never going to get, it's infinite, yeah. You know? So I feel like the biggest learning I've had is to not get into that mad rush and to kind of be here.
Amazing. So beautiful. I know we'd both love to hear so much about every other course and what inspired it, but we're sadly just about out of time. So it's your turn for the
okay,
cherry bomb rapid fire. Neera, sweet or salty?
Salty.
Salty. What did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, it's going to make me sound like a bit of a pig, but
a glass of wine.
Yeah, no, that's lunch. That's right here. I had a blood sausage and the fried eggs.
At home or where?
At Breslin.
Yeah. Oh, at the Breslin.
And awesome. A nice big cappuccino.
Terrific. This question might be a little difficult because you're traveling right now, but if I were to look into your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find? Is there anything waiting for you?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, the goodies are combination, although I don't believe in using anything imported at my restaurant. I use local stuff, but I do grab a few goodies from back home. Like I'll always have, this is amazing. Like, it's like the Quebecois dulce de leche. It's like the salted caramel kind of a mixed maple syrup, salted caramel thing, which I'll cheat every morning and put a bit on my toast.
Oh my God. What's your go-to snack? Is it that?
No, my go-to snack, God, it's really different every day, but, I think cheese. I love cheese.
Yeah. What's your favorite time of day?
Morning. I'm a morning. I wake up very, very, very early in the morning and I'm like my best in the morning.
Yeah. Sounds like you two might be able to work together. Where do you want to travel to next?
I have, well, New York's my favorite place in the world, but I've been dying to go to Japan. Mm. I want to go farm in Japan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'd love to see what would come out of that experience. My last question. What was your favorite meal when you were a child?
Well, I told you guys the foreword for my book is about, it's called The Calcutta Virgin. Mm-hmm. So in Calcutta, when I was little and I went to India with my mom, which is only once actually, so when I haven't been much before I lived there, I ate what we call a golgappa, and in Bengali people call it, in Calcutta they call it puchka. And so some of my friends call me Puchki because it was really one of the most, it's the first time I fell in love. And it was with food. it was with this. It's like a wafer, and you fill spicy water in it. And you know, I just love spice, and it opened up my senses in a different way. And my really dear friend Rosalind wrote the foreword as a poem called "The Calcutta Virgin" about the first experience of eating this amazing.
That sounds amazing.
Delicious wafer.
I love that it became your nickname. Yeah. Neera, where can people find out more about you and Shainini?
At the moment, our website's been under construction for longer than I'd like to admit, but we have a Facebook page, Shainini, and usually we update that, or on Twitter, Shainini Delhi.
Awesome. Great. Yeah. Everyone will send them there. Neera, thank you so much for coming on air today and taking time out of your trip to New York to stop by Radio Cherry Bomb. Really appreciate it. And thank you again to Martha for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you guys met each other. I'm really excited to see where your conversation goes. And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1 o'clock for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.